Today's Taisho will be on case 36 in the Piyen Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Main subject, case 36 is entitled Chosha Went for a Walk. Main subject, one day Chosha went for a walk. When he returned to the gate, the head monk said, "Osho, where have you been strolling?" Chosha said, "I have come from walking in the hills." The head monk said, "Where have you been?" Chosha said, "First, I went following the fragrant grasses, and now I have returned in pursuit of the falling blossoms." The head monk said, "You are full of spring." Chosha said, "Better than autumn dews falling on lotus leaves." Secho said, "Thank you for your answer." Secho's verse, "The world without a speck of dust, what man's eyes are not open, first following the fragrant grasses, returning in pursuit of falling blossoms, the slender stork perched in the wintry trees, a crazy monkey shrieking on the age-old heights, Chosha's eternal meaning." Ah. Thank you all very much for coming to practice Zen this morning. This Saturday sits are a wonderful opportunity to deepen your practice because we get to do a lot of consecutive sitting if we have the time, and each sit takes us a little deeper into samadhi. Some of you arrived here at 7 this morning and have been here for 4 hours and are now hearing the talk, so that's 5 hours of meditation. We don't always have time to spend the whole Saturday, but it's a wonderful opportunity to deepen and deepen and deepen your sitting. So thank you very much for coming here, whether you're just able to hear the talk or you've been able to do some of the sitting. It's wonderful to see you here. So this is a koan that, like all koans, this is a koan of some deceptive simplicity. If you're not familiar with koans, you know, in Zen practice, we begin by doing, you could say, mindfulness of breath. And when people do mindfulness of breath, they don't focus on random sensations as you might in something like mindfulness practice in, say, a Vipassana center. What we focus on instead is just the breath. And even though other inputs arise as we're paying attention, we just focus on the breath. So you keep coming back to the breath and coming back to the breath. And at first, that's very difficult because thoughts get in your way and you're struggling to pull your mind back to your breath. So, you know, a lot of early Zen practice is just a struggle on the cushion. You know, you sit down, you're watching your breath for a few moments, and then you fall into this stream of consciousness and it carries you along, and then you realize where you are and you come back to the breath and so on. And this is difficult, really challenging. You know, if people stick with practicing this way for a while, something really wonderful happens. At some point, you know, it's a struggle to get back to the breath. Your thoughts carry you down the stream. It's like the stream of consciousness, right? Your thoughts carry you down the stream, and hold on just a second. Okay. Your thoughts carry you down the stream, and eventually you're swimming back up to your breath, and then you get to your breath, And for the first time, perhaps, you know, instead of watching the breath, you begin to fuse with the breath, begin to become one with the breath. And when that happens, the thoughts are a lot less compelling. They are less seductive, you could say. And you begin to stay with the breath. You begin to ground yourself in the breath. And when you ground yourself in the breath long enough, keep coming back. You'll still have thoughts, but suddenly you're able to get some traction. You're able to be in the breath. And, you know, it's almost as though now the thoughts are just blowing by like clouds in the sky. So before, every thought carried you along, like you were helplessly helplessly flailing in this rapid stream. But now you're like grounded in the breath. And the thoughts are coming and going, but you're not going with them in a way, right? And this state is usually accompanied by this wonderful sense of like security or well-being. And this is the beginning of what we call samadhi. And you can usually tell when people are entering samadhi, the teacher can tell, because people become very still. You know, when people start doing meditation initially, they sit on the cushion, and especially if they've had something bothering them during the day, you can see them sort of moving around. But you can begin to notice when people are getting into samadhi, because they begin to get very still, you know, very still for relatively long periods of time, like 20 minutes without moving at all, like a muscle. And so you're grounding yourself in the breath. The thoughts are flowing by like clouds in the sky. And you're following the breath out, out, out until it's gone. And you keep doing this. And then what happens one day, is just maybe for an instant, your mind just goes blank, right? And, you know, you might think nothing of it. It might go blank for a moment, and then you come back to your breath and you're fusing with your breath. But, you know, again, you keep practicing, and sooner or later you reach this point where you get to the end of the breath and the mind is just blank. And eventually you find yourself in that place more often. And the blankness, which seemed to be just very brief, like a finger snap, begins to have a more extended duration. And we call this in Zen mu or wu. Mu means like not or nothing. In Sanskrit, this is called shunyata, zeroness, very important. So once you can enter zeroness, this blankness, this blank state of mind, we call it mu shin or wu shin. That's blank mind or mind of emptiness. Then the teacher will often give you a koan. What is the sound of one hand clapping? If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. And the function of the koan is to, you could say, give you an utterance or a statement, which is, involves some kind of a contradiction that can't be worked out intellectually. So if I say, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. That's a contradiction. You know, you can try to think your way out of it, but it really has the effect of preventing you from beginning to operate your discriminating mind. And you fall back into that blank state. And in Zen, we think of that blank state as like the ground floor of our practice. It's the foundation of all practice. And in order to work with koans, you really need to be able to get into that blank state. Because when you start to internalize the contradiction of the koan, and you fail to be able to resolve that contradiction intellectually, you begin to activate a deeper part of your mind, which you could say like is your active unconscious, or we say Buddha mind, your active unconscious begins to activate when your discriminating mind is unable to, is spinning around in a circle and unable to resolve this contradiction. You push yourself, you could say, even more deeply into that blankness, which at first seems like nothing at all. But ultimately, that blankness is quite important. So that's sort of like an outline of the early stages of Zen practice. So if you're not familiar with koans, you know, koans are known to people who read books on Zen, and people don't understand that they're not really like, they're not fables, or they're not meant to impart a lesson in the normal sense. So there are some koans that seem to impart a lesson, but that's really not their function. They're really, you could say, cues that you internalize. They're cues aimed at your unconscious mind. And these brilliant Zen masters in the Tang and Song dynasty had this incredible understanding of the mind. And they created these koans that people could internalize. And, you know, it's often the case that people talk about answering the koan, but, you know, they're really not answerable. The koan begins to activate your unconscious, and it takes you on a journey. It's a little bit like taking like a magic mushroom. Please don't mix magic mushrooms with your Zen practice. You know, it'd be better not to actually use magic mushrooms, actually. Zen people take a vow not to use intoxicating substances if you take precepts in the Chan, in the Zen way, and that it include magic mushrooms. But, you know, if you took a magic mushroom, you know, you wouldn't have an answer to the mushroom. You'd begin to go on a journey. And, you know, koans are like that. You're in this deep mushin state. You internalize the koan, and the koan begins to take you on a journey. It's like a journey of insight and liberation. So, you know, when you begin to work with a koan, you're in that blank state, and things begin to come up on the cushion that you might not have anticipated. It's very common in Zen training for people to come to meet with the teacher in Dokusan. And I will say, especially at Sesshin, when we do our long retreats, you know, people will come in at the end of a day of meditation and I'll say, so what's going on the cushion? Or what's going on with your koan? And they'll say, oh, nothing, nothing. And they're waiting for an answer or some kind of a resolution to the question. Maybe they're imagining that an idea will come to them. And sometimes ideas come to them, but the teacher will say, I'm sorry, that's just an idea. So what the teacher wants you to do is go on this journey, go into this emptiness and let the koan take you. This is very difficult for people because, you know, people are not used to trusting this part of their mind. When we encounter a problem, we try to solve it intellectually. Unless it's an existential problem, it can't be solved in that way. So, you know, if somebody you love dies, we all have that experience, right? Somebody you love dies, you know, there's really no way to make that right intellectually. People try. You can say, oh, he's in a better place, or now he's out of pain or something. But those are really palliative, you know, those are like these old bromides people pull up, and they have no truth value at all. They're not really helpful. They just mean I love you and I care about you, which is a good thing to communicate. But, you know, actually those kinds of events can't be solved, you know, through discriminating mind. You know, you have to go through a transformation process where you go into that deep place in yourself, that emptiness, which is actually not really in yourself, but we imagine it as in ourselves. You go into that emptiness and you begin to process your fear and loss and so on. And you come out on the other side of that in a very different state of mind, very connected, very open, and so on. So that's the koan process. Okay. So this is a koan that seems innocuous enough, right? One day Chosha went for a walk. When he returned to the gate, the head monk said, "Osho, where have you been strolling?" And Chosha said, "I've been walking in the hills." The head monk said, "Where have you been?" And Chosha said, "First I went following the fragrant grasses, and now I have returned in pursuit of the falling blossoms," and so on. So, when we start Zen practice, we don't know about that blankness, right? You know, one of the reasons people begin to do Zen practice is because they feel some kind of dissatisfaction with everyday life. You know, they feel overwhelmed by things in their lives, or they carry with them past experiences that color the experience in the present moment. So, you know, if you've had a loss, you know, I remember meeting a woman long ago. When I was hitchhiking across the United States, I had a chance to work in a restaurant, an Italian restaurant in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I did that for about 4 months, saving up money so I could go backpacking in the Pecos wilderness and other wilderness areas. And I got to know this young woman, and she was such a remarkable person. She had a kind of liveliness, but when you sat with her for a while, that liveliness would subside, and it was hard to put your finger on, right? But there was a kind of sadness to her affect. It was interesting, you know? We would go out together, and she'd be very lively for a while. But then when things got quiet, she'd get, you know, there'd be a kind of, it wasn't like she was looked sad, but there'd be a kind of wistfulness. Or, and, you know, when I got to know her, she told me her story once. We weren't intimate. We weren't in love or something like that. We were just friends. And we were working in the same restaurant. She was a college student, and I was the cook, and she was a waitress, right? But she said, you know, both of my parents got emphysema, you know, and she had to care for both of her parents who had emphysema while she was in high school, you know. And, you know, so I think she carried this with her, right, through her life. And, you know, eventually she got very interested. She began to study with this teacher in Albuquerque, I learned years later. You know, people... something brings us to practice, right? And it may be that just things are bothering you. You're overwhelmed, or you find yourself angry all the time, whatever. So anyway, you know, people come to a Zen center, or they come to a Zen temple, or they go to a mindfulness place. You sit down on the cushion and you begin to watch your breath. And in, say, mindfulness, you watch your sensations, right? And you're watching your sensations, or you're watching your breath for the longest time, you know, and it's just like a flowing stream. It's like the stream of consciousness. These things are flowing by, flowing by, flowing by. You want to get some kind of release from your practice. And if you keep watching your breath, or you keep paying attention to your sensations, you begin to have this experience of, like, the experience I described a little earlier, where, you know, at first you're carried along by your thoughts or your emotional distress, or you're carried along by your memory, you know, like memories that you can't let go of. And it's just like you're tumbling along. And then, you know, you have this experience where you're watching the breath, and you suddenly feel like grounded. And it's a beautiful experience. That experience of samadhi is like, it's like you're being swept down this stream, and you suddenly grab onto something where you can hold still. It's like grabbing a rock and you can hold still in this torrent, and you can climb up and sit there in the torrent, and you can be sedate and quiet and calm. And, you know, once we're not being swept along by the current of our thoughts, you know, we can sit quietly and calmly in samadhi. We're in a very different place emotionally. You know, we feel safe. Maybe for the first time in a long time, you know, once you can begin to enter samadhi, you feel safe and you feel at home. These are feelings that people routinely have when they start to enter samadhi. So it's like you're in this torrent and now you're in this safe place and you can rest and you look around and you see the cattails on the bank of the stream, or you hear the birds chirping. And this is like you're able to enter what we call one-pointed attention for the first time. You know, most people are so distracted, it's very difficult for them to have this like one-pointed attention. So once you're in samadhi, you know, you're in a different state of consciousness. You're not so distracted you can't focus. And you hear a bird and you can zero in, or you're watching your breath and you become the breath. You become the bird, the sound of the bird. And this, you know, life becomes so much better, right, when this happens. And for many people, this is as far as meditation practice takes them. And it's great. It's a wonderful condition of sort of like partial liberation. But, you know, if you practice Zen long enough, or any form of meditation long enough, you'll begin to notice that this isn't all there is, right? You know, whether in Zen, the teacher will direct you to something, but after you enter samadhi, but if you hadn't received that direction, you'd still find it sooner or later. You know, I actually started meditating myself before I had a teacher. So, you know, in my travels, I began to read books on Zen practice and how to do meditation. And I remember being in like this, sitting with a friend and meditating one night. And his house was really cold. He turned the heat down at night to save money. And I was by myself for many hours, and I sat down and I started meditating, and I went into this very, very blank state. It was really blank. And at the time, I didn't know what it was, and I certainly noticed that it was remarkable. But, you know, only later, when I was practicing Zen with Genki Roshi, did I realize that this was Mushin, that I had sort of stumbled into Mushin. And, you know, Mushin is this, that you're watching your breath, or you're watching your sensations, and you begin to notice that there are these, what you actually don't necessarily become aware of it in quite this way, but you begin to notice that there are these spaces in your between your moments of awareness. And so, you know, we think of consciousness as consistent and continuous. And if you practice observing moment by moment, you will begin to notice that consciousness is not continuous, that there are moments of blankness in between your moments of awareness. This is actually a discovery many people don't make for a long time in their practice, especially like in Vipassana practice. You can spend a lot of time, and I'm not comparing different practices, I'm just saying you can spend a lot of time observing your sensations before you realize that your sensations are not all there is to your field of awareness. That, you know, there's this, you feel pain in your leg, then you hear the fan, then you hear the bird, then you have a thought, then you feel pain in your leg, and so on and so on. You can spend a lot of time noting these moments of awareness. before you discover that there are spaces in between. So actually, it's not the case that there's a stream of consciousness. Consciousness is more like a series of flashes on the screen of your mind, so that there's a flash, and then there's a blankness, and then there's a flash, and then there's a blankness, and then there's a flash, and there's a blankness. And if you pay a lot of attention to this phenomenon, you know, once in Zen, we ask you to actually watch the blankness. We say mu, go into the blankness. So the teacher directs you into the blankness. But even if the teacher did it, sooner or later, you'd discover this blankness. And you'd realize that the stream of consciousness isn't a continuous stream. There are these blank spaces. And so every moment of consciousness actually has the same structure, you could say. Every moment of consciousness has the same structure. So there's a blankness, and then there's an emergent moment of form. You know, this is called form. And at the front of the moment, there's just pure experience. And in Japanese Zen, this is called a nen, the first nen. The first nen is like the first part of a moment. So you're coming out of blankness, you hear something, like a car driving by. And for a moment, there's just pure sound of car. There's no you, and there's no sound. It's just pure sound. Your consciousness is 100% sound. Then there's a thought. And then there's an emotional, there's an affective sort of like recoil. So in that second nen, when there's a thought, self-consciousness arises. And once self-consciousness arises, you begin to have an emotional dimension to your experience, which is actually karmically determined. So the way this works is that you come out of emptiness, you go into the moment, and at the beginning of every moment, it's just pure experience. Then in the second part of the moment, the second nen, there's thought. And in the third nen, as the moment is actually deteriorating and slipping back into emptiness, there's an affective dimension. And every moment, if you observe carefully, has exactly this same structure. Right? You know, in our practice, we are really, a lot of the time what we do is we are really bringing our attention to the front of the moment. So, you know, when we're practicing Zen, we try not to be in the second or third nen. We try to keep our attention focused on the first nen, the front of the moment. In the Pali Sutras, one of the things the Buddha says that's a little puzzling is he said at one point, I am always at the beginning. I'm always at the beginning. And, you know, if you don't know about the structure of the moment, that might seem like a really cryptic, what does that mean, I'm always at the beginning? But what the Buddha was saying is I'm always bringing my attention back to the front of the moment. So a lot of Zen practice involves learning how to focus on the first nen. And it's difficult to focus on the first nen if you aren't aware of the spaces, believe it or not. It's like when you enter the mushin, you go into those spaces between your moments of awareness and you come out into the moment. It's like your mind is like a tabula rasa. It's like blank. And now you can really be aware without anything interfering. And you can be right at the front of the moment, right? Right in that first nen. And you can't stop it. So you can stay in the first nen. You can become pretty good at staying in the first nen. But sooner or later, there is going to be thinking and there is going to be an emotional dimension. So if it happens, you haven't failed, right? You're not failing. It's a natural progression. And it's complicated why this happens, but you can't stop it. So sometimes people go into deep mushin when they first start practicing emptiness meditation. They go into deep mushin and they're like in this very deep place, very blank. And all of a sudden they have a thought, you know, hey, I'm in a deep place. I'm in a very blank place. And they feel like, oh, I've ruined it. But actually, you can't not think like that. Your thoughts are going to arise as you enter the second nin. So this is like, but what we do in Zen is we try not to we don't spend too much time in the second and third nin. You know, it's like we're surfing the waves of the mind and we keep hitting that front of that wave. And a lot of Zen practice is learning how to stay at the front of the wave. So you come out of emptiness and you're in this moment. You just stay in that thoughtless state for a long time and then thoughts arise and the moment fades away and you go back into emptiness. So this is like a lot of Zen practice involves like surfing the waves of the mind. You come out of the trough, which is emptiness. You go up the wave and you go down the wave and back into the trough. And this is really how practice works for a long time. And if you have this sort of model, that'll be very helpful to you. You know, you keep staying. I studied with one Japanese teacher. His name was Edo Shimano, and Shimano Edo Roshi. And he used to just tell his students, first nen, first nen, first nen, right? So, stay in the first nen. But, you know, actually, this is an intermediate stage of practice. And one way to understand this koan is that walking in the garden, I've gone walking in the mountains, could describe like one way to experience this koan is he's really talking about being in the first nen again and again and again and again. See, and if you came into the teacher and you said, you know, every moment is just 100% moment. Or if you just brought in a flower and you said 100% flower, you brought in a blade of grass and you said 100% blade of grass, I think the teacher would probably pass you. You know, so that that would be a pretty good response if the koan takes you to the discovery of the first nen. That would be a pretty good response to this koan. But there's, you know, koans have many layers or levels. You know, it's not the case that when people come in to see the teacher in Dokusan, you know, sometimes the answer is just way off base, right? So somebody might come in and they might say, this is about eating dinner, you know, and the teacher might say, no, I just don't see that, you know, I'm sorry, that you're pretty far off. Somebody might come in with an intellectual answer. That's pretty far off. You might come in, though, with a pretty good answer, see? And what that means is you've followed the koan pretty far. You've let it take you pretty far. And it's shown you some very important things, but you could go farther, see? So it's a judgment call for the teacher to say when, you know, this koan has taken you as far as it can take you. And sometimes I will say to students, let's stay with the koan a little longer and see what happens. And sometimes students will come back in and they'll report, you know, something further that the koan has opened up that's really exciting. And sometimes they'll say, nothing's happening, and I'll give them another koan. But in the case of this koan, there's something else that there's like another dimension to this koan. When we practice Zen, we move from what you could call the surface to a deeper place. So the surface is the stream of consciousness. This happens and this happens and this happens and this happens and this happens. And when we learn how to enter Mushin, it's like we pull that curtain back, right? It's like, this happens, this happens, this happens, this, and it creates like a surface. It's like a surface, right? we pull that surface back, we pull that those curtains back like a screen, we pull that screen back, and behind the screen, there's just emptiness, see, emptiness. So a lot, initially, you know, that's how we practice. You know, you sit down on the cushion, you pull back the screen, and you go into the darkness, right? It's just like looking in a looking through a door in a dark into a dark room. And you know, we keep going into that darkness and into that darkness and into that darkness, and it keeps purifying our karma, purifying our karma. So every time you go into that darkness, it's like wiping the slate clean, so that when you come back to the moment, the first nen, you can see with fresh eyes, you can see clearly. But, you know, if you keep practicing, eventually in Zen practice, we have what's called like Dai Kensho experience. And Dai Kensho is something that happens sometime in your practice. I don't know when you can't make it happen, but it's like a change in the character of your experience of emptiness. You know, for the longest time, when we encounter those spaces between the waves of form, they're blank and dark. But at some point in our practice, they become bright, like blindingly bright. And if you imagine something blindingly bright, it's not really what I'm talking about. It's not an image. But it's like, I don't know if you've ever seen, blank movie screen, right? You know, movie screen seems to be full of images, you know. And if you turn the projector off, there's just a bright light on the screen. You know, that's the foundation of consciousness, actions, just like that. Or I don't know if you've ever had a chance to see shadow puppets in some parts of Southeast Asia. They have a shadow puppet theater, which must have been a Buddhist invention. It must have been. Because, you know, it involves this screen. And you, behind this, it's like a waxed paper screen, and it's transparent. It's not quite transparent, but it's almost transparent. It's like waxed paper. And behind the screen, they have a number of candles, and they have these paper cutout puppets. And so what you're watching is a screen, like a movie screen, and behind the screen are these dark puppets, and they are like... often figures from the Ramayana, from Indian epics, right? From the Ramayana, and people watch this, and this is like a brilliant model of how of what consciousness is really like, right? So you know, when you practice long enough, that darkness of movie is like a blank, like the blank screen in a movie house when they shut off the projector, like the shadow puppet play in Indonesia or Southeast Asia, right? You know, the ground of consciousness is like that radiant surface. You know, that is how Buddha mind really is, really. In the early Pali Sutras, when the Buddha was asked to describe enlightened mind, he actually held up a piece of white cloth, and he said, it's like this. So you know, it would be very helpful, I think, if you think about the reality as having two dimensions, like a front and a back, or a foreground and a background. You know, when people in the West think about heaven or God, they think of God in the sky, right? So when we think of like God is in the sky and this is the earth. So there's earth and there's sky, up and down. See, not front and back, but up and down. So for us, you know, the transcendent or the sacred or whatever in the West is in heaven, and this is the earth, right? The gods dwell in another place far from here, you know, but actually, you know, Buddhism has a little different understanding of things, right? It's like everything is happening in the foreground is happening. You know, your kids are getting ready to go to school. You have to do a report for work. And that's the foreground. That's like the movie playing, right? But there's a background, which is like this luminous ground, right? Background, this luminous ground. Most people never discover the luminous ground. They have no idea. It's not their fault. It's just the way it works out. But, you know, when you practice the Buddha's way long enough, you realize that these are like both dimensions of reality. That there's like reality has a foreground and a background. And the foreground is all this stuff that's happening. It's like the movie. And the background is like this radiant field, this radiant ground, which is we say Buddha mind. Right. And these two things are like happening at the same time, all the time. It's a little hard for our discriminating mind to take this in, but these are both dimensions of reality, and they're simultaneous, and they're mutually creating, you could say. So, you know, the average person who doesn't do any zazen is just caught up in the movie. You know, the person sees Indiana Jones trying to jump on the train and is terrified, right? And so on. When we begin to do zazen, you know, we learn how not to be too taken in by the movie, and we begin to focus on our breath and we get calmer. It's like, you get so anxious, you watch the breath and you ground yourself in the breath and you aren't so overwhelmed by the constant stream of images, right? If you stay with your breath, you begin to notice that between those flashes on the screen, there are these spaces. So it's like a movie projector that has begun to break down and you can actually see the frames projected on the screen. And then if the movie stops, you just have the bright white screen. So one way to think about where people are heading in their practice is that we're releasing ourselves from being in a spell of a mistaken view of reality as just this sequence of images on the screen. And we learn how to ground ourselves in the moments between those flashes of form. That's Muxin. And if we stay in Muxin, the character of Muxin gradually transforms as our egos are, as we let go of our egos more and more, we can see reality, we can see more clearly the real nature of enlightened mind. So enlightened mind appears to be blank and dark, but at some point its character changes. We're ready to see it with clean eyes, right? We've purified our minds enough to see what it really is, not blank and dark, but blank and bright. And then we realize that, you know, basically, as we move through the world, both of these things are dimensions, right? It's like there's spring, summer, winter, fall. There's getting a bad grade on your paper. There's, you know, having your kid yell at you in the hallway. There's having your car break down on the Garden State Parkway and having to wait 5 hours for somebody to tow you, right? All of that. That's the front. But behind this, there's like the radiant ground. And you could say the last part of Zen practice is being able to bring these two together, right? Bring these two together. You know, the radiant ground and this, and the stream of form, you know. And so this is really what Chosha is talking about, really. These are like, this is what he means by going for a walk, right? He's going through this whole process, right? You know, walking, swept along by the world of form, finding this still place in a turning world, the still point in a turning world. Staying with the still point until you discover emptiness. Staying with emptiness until you purify body, mind, and word, and can perceive emptiness for what it really is, which isn't empty at all, but like this, the radiant ground. And then integrating the radiant ground into the world of form, not two. And that's like the most advanced, that's a final stage of Zen practice. So, you know, when we begin to practice Zen, we think, that we are trying to wake up. We're in darkness and we're trying to wake up. You know, but somebody like Weineng or Dogen Zenji, you know, again and again, they say, don't think of your practice that way. See, don't think of practice as trying to get something you don't already have, right? It's the radiant ground is always there. It's always there. We're not always aware of it. But, you know, when we practice, we think we're practicing because we want to wake up, because there's something we don't have that we're trying to get. And Dogen Zenji and Weineng say, look, the reason you're practicing is because the radiant ground is already manifesting in your life. Right? The reason you came to the cushion is because the radiant ground is already speaking to you. You know, if somebody says, you know, really, why do you do Zen? You know, you can say, well, I'm doing meditation because I want to be more effective in my work. You know, but you know that's not true. You know, that's not true. Or you could say, well, I'm it's helping me cope with my anxiety, and that's true, but probably you could cope with your anxiety in other ways, actually. And actually, your anxiety probably goes away fairly soon in the process. So why are you practicing Zen, right? You know, I remember years ago, Genki Roshi took me to see this movie in Seattle on training at Daitokuji. Genki Roshi himself trained at Daitokuji. And he wanted me to see this movie. Some Japanese film crew had made this movie about training at Daitokuji, and it was pretty impressive, right? It was, you know, these guys get up in the morning and they get water to wash their faces, and to get the water into the barrel, they have to break the ice on the top of the barrel, right? So they have to break the ice, and then you wash your face with like this super cold water. So they go through the day. It just takes them through one day, and at one point one of the interviewers said to this Zen monk, he said, why are you doing this? And the guy, his face, he couldn't answer. His face was just like blank, right? And Genki Roshi thought that was really funny. I didn't get it at the time. But it was, you know, your big mind is asking you to do this. You know, there's a part of the radiant ground which is manifesting itself already in your life. And that's why you're sitting. You may be sitting because it helps you with your anxiety. You may be sitting because of this and that. But really, you know, it's because you are already Buddha. And the Buddha part of you is expressing itself as your practice. The Buddha part of you is expressing itself as your practice. And, you know, when we listen to the Buddha part of ourselves, you know, we feel great. We feel alive. You know, it may be difficult to get up on a Saturday. We want to sleep in. But, you know, you listen to the Buddha nature in yourself, the radiant ground in yourself, and you feel alive. You feel the presence of that radiant ground, and everything becomes beautiful. See? So that's what Chosha is saying, right? You know, when you act from that place, everything becomes beautiful. Everything comes alive. One day, Chosha went for a walk. When he returned to the gate, the head monk said, "Osho, where have you been strolling?" Chosha said, "I have come from walking in the hills." The head monk said, "Where have you been?" Chosha said, "First I went following the fragrant grasses, and now I have returned in pursuit of the falling blossoms." Nen, nen, nen. First nen, first nen, first nen. The head monk said, "You are full of the spring." Chosha said, "Better than the autumn dews falling on lotus leaves." Secho's verse, "The world without a speck of dust." See, that's radiant ground and world of form merged. "What man's eyes are not opened? First following the fragrant grasses, returning in pursuit of the falling blossoms. The slender stork perched in the wintry tree, the crazy monkey shrieking in the age-old heights. Chosha's eternal meaning, the radiant ground." Ah,